sure that they have the stuff for them. We need to make sure that the journalists have the things that they need when they come.
What do journalists need?
Journalists need a number of things. They need to be able to find how to reach you. You would be amazed at how many websites you cannot find a phone number on. And I'm not talking about like customer service for Electrolux who doesn't want you to call, or you know, customer service for Travelocity who you know really, really don't want you to call. But I mean people who actually want you to be able to call. And notwithstanding that this could overwhelm emails, and there are ways to put these in so that spam filters don't pick them up, so that people trying to spam you don't pick it up, you need to be able to email the staff and the outreach people for the shul. I think you need to be able to email the director of a school. I think you need to be able to email the rabbi of a synagogue and not have it come up with info@rodefshalom.org. Now, do you type out the words AT and the little caret greater than less than sign instead of have the symbol at so that someone phishing can't pull the email addresses and then send you tons of spam so you can't actually click on the email address? Okay, fine. You know, maybe. If you're a shul of, you know, 2,200 family units and you find people are really coming there and spamming you, do you put up the security thing where you have to type those horrible words like you do on, you know, Ticketmaster? I would argue no, I'd rather get spam than do that, but you know, I'm willing to have that conversation. Whether you need to. And then everything from the most basic, hours, phone numbers, when the services are, how to access youth group and other activities and family activities, the places where people come in, people need to see, but the journalists need to see that also. And then if you've got a special program, something going on, something great, it's got to be front and center. And that usually, to me, is more of a speaker who's coming in, who's fairly prominent, more than the Purim Carnival. I don't think the journalists are coming in to find the Purim Carnival, but, you know, gosh knows, I am. You know, I want to be able to see. Sorry,
just looking at the synagogue website, and they have the Purim Carnival.
Oh, excellent!
The website,
and that's the Purim Carnival.
And the front page is the Purim Carnival picture.
Okay.
But it's not only for journalists.
But not only for journalists, right?
It's for the membership.
It needs to be a balance. Sorry, just one second. My mother was in D.C. visiting us 3 weeks ago. She's saying Kaddish for my grandmother, and it was an enormous, enormous challenge to figure out when Mincha and Marv were at any shul in Washington on Shabbos, except for us. Aris had it on there. It was great. There was one small problem, which I'm still apologizing to the rabbi who was there that day, that it was Mincha and Marv together with learning in the middle, which I didn't know. I thought it was just Mincha. And I had taken my mother and father and my wife and left the kids at home with a friend and told them I would be home. So we got done with them, and they said, okay, you know, we're going to learn for the next 45 minutes. And then Davar Marv, I'm like, oh my gosh, what do I do? How do I get? Oh no. And we're in the middle, and it was packed. I wound up getting up and leaving, and I called him afterwards and apologized and thought that I had a good reason, but I'm still, you can tell that I'm still a little messed up about that. But please, Dan.
What you're saying presupposes that journalists are interested in synagogue websites.
That's exactly right.
And I'm wondering, I mean, I can hear you, if you, given that we have synagogue websites, we ought to be thinking about what we want to present, but aside from an occasional board, you know, journalist from the Jewish Times of Baltimore, I'm not sure that anybody's all that interested. So I'm wondering, our websites, synagogue websites, where it's at? Should we be getting out of synagogue websites, using other sorts of things? What's going to bring people? I mean, I could see maybe somebody clicking through a blog or clicking through a Facebook, you know, a post, or and ending up at our website and saying, okay, yes, and now that you're here, we want to make sure that the correct information is front and center, and here's the phone number. But am I naive about this? I mean,
you're exactly right.
Or is the Baltimore Sun cruising Chizik Emunah's website looking for interesting material?
They are not. But they are not.
Actually, they are. That's because they belong to Chizik Emunah.
Let's get all five of them. That's
right. Oh, yeah, the paper has shrunk a little bit. They are not, and I should add, when they come to you, you need to make sure they're finding what they need for you. There are a handful of times that journalists will come to the websites unannounced or uninvited. They haven't pitched them and told them, please come and see what's going on. One time is when there's big news. I spent 2 days last week with Rick Jacobs, the incoming head of URJ, and as we were going to announce him, I wanted to know what was on what was on his temple's website. Well, he had every sermon he's given the last however many years was posted on his website on the rabbi's page. Okay. Whether they should be or not, that's a separate thing. That's something, so journalists were going to come to that website. Another time of year when journalists do, we pretend in our office that we know what rabbis are going to sermonize on for the holidays. And we make a big pitch to national religion reporters. Includes Baltimore Sun. It's okay, but you also need to talk to the rabbis in your area about what they're sermonizing on. And we, you know, talk to a handful of people and then can guess what people are going to be talking about. You know, is it Israel? Economy? This, you know, Madoff? Like some kind of threads that run through, we hope. And then if they buy into this, they might say, oh, well, let's see what's going on in our neighborhood. And they'll actually come unannounced. But usually, yes, they are not coming to you. It's when they do come to you, because you give them a reason to, can they get to you, can they get what they want?
Matt, I'll go back to Rick Jacobs.
Sure.
So did you tell him to leave the sermons up or take them down?
His idea, actually, was to take them down and then put them back up. That a selective person going through 200 sermons over the last few years, taking stuff out of context, could find something that would not be fair to his whole body of work.
In general, is it a good idea for rabbis to post sermons?
I think so. I do think so.
Archives?
Unless the rabbi is, you know, Rabbi Jeremiah Wright, Obama's pastor in Chicago, I would think that it's a good idea to make yourself as accessible as possible to your congregants. But does that mean every single sermon?
The problem is that sermons have changed. And there was a time when rabbis wrote out their entire sermons, and therefore there was a text to post. Many rabbis, I would dare say most rabbis, aren't doing that. That makes what you're saying very difficult.
I would say, if you have them, I would not spend time on Tuesday coming back and going back through and typing this up. I don't think that's a good use of time. I also think, let me actually edit that answer. I think if you've been doing it, you probably have to keep doing it. I think if you're not doing it, I would rather self-select. I would rather choose what I want someone to read than give them a choice of, okay, 45 sermons, 40 sermons, how many sermons we're doing a year. So I would rather pick up my three or four big ones.
Or post them for the year, and then in subsequent years, you have the highlights from 2011.
It's a function of the congregant who missed shul but actually does want to hear or read it, versus, okay, that's been up a week, take it down because it's not my idea, my biggest hit, kind of thing. Like, is there between text and audio?
No, I don't think there. I think, again, I would not, if you don't write your sermons, I would not start writing them for your website.
Sure.
I think both people who will see them.
Unless you pick a pair of
them. But I do write them.
So, okay.
But I can also audio post them.
I would do both. If you have both, I would definitely do both. I would do both. I know a lot of rabbis and synagogues who post their high holiday sermons, both as audio and as text. And one who's got an archive, she just celebrated 20 years in her pulpit and has 20 years of sermons on the website from the High Holidays, which I think is a very nice thing to have. And then this is like the Cal Ripken streak or the person who voted for every vote in Congress. Once you start it, you got to keep it going. But I think there are very few of us who will ever have to go back and look at everything that we wrote and look for the vulnerabilities there. Because I'm sure we all have said things that we don't want pulled out in that little bracket, little piece.
Would you turn that around, for example, if the rabbi feels that he wants to make it into the press, that he take a sermon and specifically target a journalist and say, this is what I spoke about, or this is what I'm speaking about, I'd like you to have the text?
I do think so. I think there are a couple of examples when this actually was newsworthy. There was an Orthodox rabbi in New York who criticized Madoff. And Madoff was not, but Madoff's business partner was a member of his shul. And they were very concerned that, you know, it's the Shana for the Goyim. The Jews were getting a bad rap because of Madoff. And he wanted to speak out against Madoff and have folks noticed it. So we used the sermon, and we turned the sermon into an op-ed and pitched around and shared around with a couple of key journalists. That's a good example. When we have something to say that's unique and different and could rise to the level of news, that tends to more or less, and I'll admit, I'm a, you know, Beltway monster rat inside the Beltway, and I've lived there for long enough that I forget what it's like to live outside the Beltway, if you count New York as outside the Beltway, that I think of these things as news, as, you know, public affairs, what's happening in news that's interesting. But news could be a charter school fight in New York. News could be tuition to schools or school vouchers or some other piece or some really hip new education idea that's not Jewish specific, but is something that's being talked about, as opposed to Congress is voting on this and we need to talk about this. It could be, you know, some new thing in music. It could be, you know, Debbie Friedman was the darling of the reform movement. What's the conservative movement doing? How is, you know, our music changed? What's the Karl Bach of this or that? There's like ways to make this relevant outside of Congress. And then ways to get these placed as op-eds. We can talk about that in a little bit, how to actually get that piece out there. So you were going to...
Yeah. Ultimately, putting stuff up so the journalists will see it, call it, and report on it. Really, the end result that you want is you want people to come to your stuff. What's this? Is there a straight line? How do you tell not just what are journalists gonna? How do you put up there not just what's gonna interest them, but what's going to translate into more people through your door?
It's a very good question, and you could probably spend the time from now until the end of the conference Thursday, right? Discussing whether a synagogue's role is to cater to its membership, or whether a synagogue's role is to cater to the larger Jewish community to try to encourage members to come in, which is a debate, philosophy, and all that happening going on.
Assume it's the latter.
Assume it's the latter.
Just for the purpose of this question. Assume it's the latter.
I believe that there's the synagogue bulletin, there's the local Jewish paper, depending on where you are, how, you know, bullshit that paper is or not. You know, Baltimore happens to be one of the best papers in the country. Was it better 10 years ago? Yes. Scranton, Pennsylvania, I don't know if you have a Jewish paper.
We have the Forward.
Okay, you have the Forward. Washington, D.C. has
a... Reporter.
The Reporter, okay. Washington, D.C. has the Washington Jewish Week that is a very good paper, but is read by a tiny, tiny fraction of the Jewish community.
Which is the story with the IJM.
And chances are, everyone who is reading the Jewish newspaper is already somehow involved with a synagogue. And if not with a synagogue, they've made a choice, an affirmative choice, not to be involved with a synagogue. So it gets to mainstream media. How do we reach people who we're not currently reaching? And that is, you know, the key test.
But I think it's a good question. I think if I'm hearing what you're asking short of buying a spot, right?
Yeah.
Buying an ad. You want to strategically get a message out. You want people to come to program X or discussion Y. What do you suggest?
Thank you for actually focusing that, because I will say that coming to discussion X or Y will almost never get covered. And it will almost never get covered before the event in a way to get people to come to the event. The way to do that and to get that is through other non-traditional means. I would also argue that you can't afford in any of the places that you are, almost, to advertise in print media, certainly broadcast media also, to get people to come to these events. It's cost prohibitive to take an ad in the Baltimore Sun that anyone would actually see. You know, you could feel good, do a little tiny ad, but no one's going to see it. We are a huge, huge fan of Facebook advertising. Facebook advertising is incredibly inexpensive. You only pay if someone clicks on it, not if it just shows up on their page. And you can micro-target it to someone who self-identifies, so they have to self-ID as Jewish on their profile. But if they do, you can then target it by age, geography, and you can target it by other things that they are following in friends with. We have had significantly less success with advertising on JD, which has made me very sad, because it's a phenomenal audience of captive people in a certain demographic. My colleagues and staff who are on JD, to a person, this was five people, did not know there were ads on JD. They didn't believe me that there were ads on JD until they went back on and logged in and saw the ads on JD. So that's one way, and that's a paid way. We all know who are the serial tweeters and the serial Facebook posters in our congregations and our schools, and if we don't, we should figure out who they are. Because they are, what's the old marketing term? They're the mavens. They're the ones who people listen to, people will see. And that's a way, a free way, to get people outside of our world to notice those events and to get them to do, get them to see them. The other way, which is, and all of these are hopefully not time-consuming ways. Once you set up a Facebook advertising profile, it costs, you know, you could spend, you don't say, I'm gonna spend $50 on this. You cap it at $50, because if, you know, 250 people click through and see it, that's amazing. You know, even if you got 30 of them to come, that's more people than you could ever reach through any other means. That's very cost effective. This is all very time effective. None of this takes any time. Once you set up that Facebook profile, you just click the click, put the credit card in, save, and you're now able to do that. The other way is to partner, share, swap, shepherd email lists. There are other organizations in your area, in your town, in your city, that you could ask them to send an email out for you onto their list to shepherd it for you. And the payback is that you'll do it for them. And hopefully your privacy policies allow that on your websites. If they don't, I'm not one who really cares much about privacy policies on websites, but there are others who do and sticklers who do and think you can't do that. And then you only capture, you only get the names of the people who actually click on the shepherd email from, you know, the Federation sends it out to people in your zip code area, and you get people who come in, and then you offer to send something out to the Federation for you, for them, at some point down the road.
When you say Facebook, are you speaking to a population that is below the average age of our membership seminars?
Shockingly, no. One of the problems with Facebook now is that it's become the parent and grandparent generation Facebook. And that the younger kids don't want to be on it. And one of the biggest dilemmas is, if the grandfather friends the 14-year-old, does the 14-year-old have to friend the grandfather? Or does my wife call the grandfather and say, Dad, stop. You know, she's your niece and she's entitled to some privacy. Hi, Arthur. She's entitled to some privacy, just in case he sees this somehow on camera, and defriends her, unfriends her. So we don't reach everybody this way. And there's no one magic bullet for this. But we also can't snail mail, even at a nonprofit rate, these big lists to try to get audiences in. But it is a good way to crowd build. But if someone said to me, we're only going to do Facebook, I would actually challenge that. If someone said to me, we're going to offer an option to put our bulletin only online to save paper and mailing costs, I would actually argue against it.
For our programming, for our 20 through 30 something old, our real advertising is done on Facebook. Our advertising, so our parents know that we're doing that, is done in our traditional ways.
That's well.
But we actually reach them through Facebook, but we advertise for the programs on in our newsletter, but we know that that's not actually reaching anyone except the parents, who say, oh, it's so nice the synagogues do.
But which is a very important audience. It's a very important audience. The Reform Movement is doing a intro to Jewish learning class in New York and I think in the Washington area. I should actually know better this because my colleagues are actually placing the ads for this. And their goal is to pull in people from way outside, and they're spending, they've got a grant for this, they're spending a decent amount of money in things like Time Out New York, which is the type of publication people go to learn what shows and movies and arts and culture things are playing. It's not cost effective. because you're reaching so many non-Jews to get to the few number of Jews that are out there. You can't advertise in the New York Times to reach, you know, a cohort of people who could come to a Scarsdale synagogue, suburban New York synagogue.
But you can target. So I'm just trying to understand. So you can target specific zip codes, for example, if you know where the Jewish neighborhoods are. You target
by mail, you can, or by email. Oh, sorry, email. Sorry,
by
yes.
Facebook.
Facebook. You can target. I don't believe you can. You can definitely geo-target. I don't believe you can geo-target that
specifically.
I'm actually positive. Almost,
I think there's anything now that you can actually, because I think that we just in Vancouver. We're starting.
I'm not sure I would, though. Okay.
How would
you could
micro-target it?
Depends what city you're in. It depends how big the city is. If you're in Chicago, there are different neighborhoods of Chicago. But if it's done by where they're dialing into Facebook from, you could actually miss someone who's in their office, someone who's at their home,
right,
or someone's on their cell phone. You could miss the zip code that they're coming in, and you miss someone who you would want.
You have profile pieces, like if it says Jewish, obviously. If it says...
It says Jewish. If you are a member of any other Jewish... If you're following or friends of any other Jewish organization, I almost don't care who they are. Right, left, or center. Someone who's you know, following any sort of Jewish publication, Israeli publication, friends of, you know, Magen David Adom, something like that. Obviously, anyone who's a friend or follower of a synagogue, some of this gets you easier there. Zip code targeting, I would say if you shepherded a list or swapped a list with the Federation or swapped a list with anyone else, they should have, you know, their fields of first name, last name, email address, zip code. You can pull. If you've got a 300-person email list, we have a 3,000-person email list, you're going to trade 300 to 300, give them your zip codes, let them pull the first 300 off the zip codes that match.
Mm-hmm.
How to get the mainstream media to cover or care about what you have to care about so we could pull people in, which I think was Sue's question, it's a much heavier lift. It's a much harder lift. The local weekly newspaper, if there is one, is an easier mark than the local daily newspaper, which is generally an easier mark than the local TV station or the local news broadcast station. Or if there's a blog or some kind of web publication, would fall into that also. How to get into them? Let's do this in two pieces. One is, we need to think like they think. So what is that? And then two, what do we say to them so we can actually get into their publications? The worst thing anyone can do for a journalist is to call them at 5 o'clock at night when they're on deadline with some other story, with something that's not urgent, with a bumbling, not well thought out pitch to them, speech to them. And that doesn't work. The second worst thing we could do is call them with something that they really, really want to do, but we've missed their deadline on it because we didn't understand that they have a Saturday, but still, in almost, I think everywhere we are, except for maybe Vancouver, so I haven't seen the paper there. Back in the olden days, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, the churches started to advertise in the newspapers. So it became a Saturday church page. There's a Saturday religion page. It's still there in all of our towns. The New York Times still carries their column on Saturday. The Washington Post has a whole page on Saturday. That really is basically church listings. Then they hired a correspondent to write for it. And they have articles and briefs there and blurbs there. It's still there. That page goes to press on Thursday. If you call the journalist and say, Thursday, I got the greatest thing for you, they'll be annoyed because you're calling them after deadline, even more annoyed if it was something that was good. So we need to know what their deadlines are. We also need to know how they think. The local Jewish paper, almost everywhere that I can think of that we're here from, goes to press on Tuesday. It means we can't call them up on Tuesday and ask them to write a story. Really, we can't even call them up on Monday, really. We should be calling them up on Wednesday, when they've closed the last week's paper and they're planning out this week's paper, or Thursday or Friday, unless it's something truly breaking, urgent news that they would care about. For the local paper, so so so, it, In addition to the Saturday page, which is a Thursday deadline, so you want to call them on Wednesdays, these people are busy and do other things. I still think journalists are the only people in the world who can get away with, when you call them up on the phone, you tell them, hi, this is Rabbi Wahlberg calling, I'll call you back in 10 minutes, slams down the phone. But that's just rude. Why does this happen? Having been there and seen it, in most newsrooms today, even still, journalists are juggling their own phone calls. And if they're on the phone, the next call coming in could go to voicemail, they could miss that urgent call that they're waiting for. So not only do they get away with this at 10 o'clock in the morning, they really get away with this at 5 o'clock at night when they're on deadline following a story, and the last thing they want to do is have someone call them unless it's truly, truly urgent. And when we call people up that late in the day, the first words out of my mouth are, I'm so sorry to call you this late. I just want to make, I would rather you make the decision, not me, that this can wait until tomorrow. And they're usually grateful, or they'll hang up and call back in 10 minutes, I'm waiting for a call. Click, slam, you know, done.
And just to interject, and phone calls are still the way to go rather than email reporters?
It depends who the reporter is. We generally do both. The worst people, the most annoying people back when I was a journalist, even now, are the people who call in and say, hi, I'm calling to confirm that you received the email that I sent. That's a waste of everyone's time. You can ask during the conversation, I did send something on this, but it's the pitch. It's what are we going to say in those, you know, in that 10 seconds we got them, the 30 seconds that we got them, that's going to make them want to cover the story. And we'll get to that in a second, about how to make that pitch. The decisions about how they cover what they cover tend to come from the journalists themselves, not from their editors. The editors tend to be, and let me check with my editor, tends to be an excuse, unless you're writing for the New York Times, or unless you're writing for someplace like that, where they actually say, okay, I'm really into this, let me get space from my editor, and I'll call you right back. And that actually does happen. Infrequently, but it happens. The most important thing that we need to know is who's the journalist that we're going to call. What do they write about? What's their beat? What do they do? In our office, we still buy the Washington Post or the New York Times, or both if they want it, for all of our colleagues, because they need to see who's writing what story. If all of a sudden someone's not writing from the State Department for the New York Times, we need to know that. If all of a sudden someone else is writing from the Senate, we need to know that. If you can't name the person who writes the stories on your Saturday religion pages, you need to. You're not doing your media job well. If you can't name who the editor of the Jewish paper is, or the person who writes on the synagogue beat, or who the 1.5 people there are, if it is, we're not doing our job. We need to be able to. If you don't know who the education reporter is for the paper, and who tends to write these things, we need to find out. And those are the people that we need to get to know before we need them. We need to find an excuse to talk to them. We need to find an excuse to call them, so that when you're calling them, you're not for the very first time saying, hi, you don't know me, but. And that involves usually an excuse to talk to them when we're not asking them to write a story. And we find an excuse. We find if it's some interesting program that's on their beat that they tend to write about, that we want to make sure they know about and ask them to come to, and that could be email. It could be, you know, we're starting a new year off and we haven't been in touch in a while. Can we get together for coffee sometime? How about next Tuesday? Oh, that doesn't work. How about the following Wednesday? And we find a way to develop that relationship with that reporter. Please.
I get calls before each holiday. Small town, Catholic, they want to know. Is it okay for me to email them before they would call me saying, this holiday is coming up, let me give you a quick rundown?
Absolutely.
But they'd be grateful.
Absolutely.
So it's anticipated the call, but I'm assuming it's important.
Right. And what if they decide to call somebody else? What if they decide that you're either going to call some other rabbi? Then you're left out of that piece. And it happens. I'm sure that my editor said, JTA would be really happy to hear this story. But in 1996-ish, 6-7-ish, I called and I said, all right, I'm leaving the office. I'm going to a party on Capitol Hill for Hanukkah. And they said, okay, you know, we'll call you back. I get a call on the cell phone from the cab. We need you to write a story. What do you mean write a story? I'm going to a latkes and vodkas party at Steve Rabinowitz's office where I was a partner with him. I said, well, we don't have anything slated for Hanukkah. We forgot to get any stories for Hanukkah. So write me 600 words on Hanukkah. I'm sorry, on Hanukkah. I just write 600 words on Hanukkah. This is ridiculous. I'm going to just write something. So we're at the party, and I'm standing in line with a friend who actually still works for ADL in Washington. And she got into a fight with another guy whether they were going to put applesauce or sour cream on their latkes. And there was my story. The great debate on Capitol Hill today became, you know, applesauce and sour cream on latkes, of course. It was a completely ridiculous feature story that Steve has never stopped yelling over because someone covered his party. And it happens. You know, so many things happen in journalism by accident. And the things that we can control, the better. So I would definitely do that kind of outreach. And outreach around the holidays is one of the key parts for the mainstream media. That you can rely on the mainstream local paper doing a story on the high holidays. You know, pretty much year after year, no matter what, they're going to write something on the high holidays. They might write something on Passover, especially when Passover and Easter kind of fall together around Holy Week. It's a nice little Jewish-Christian story. And if you really want something, you know, it sounds like the joke, but a priest, an imam, and a rabbi walked into the bar together. You know, something that is interfaith that cuts across all lines, or even better, something that is a trend. Something that's happening in the Jewish community, but means something bigger for the non-Jewish world. Such as something hip, innovative, different in education. Something hip, innovative, different in elder care or family care.
People looking for spiritual meaning.
People looking for spiritual meaning. Is there a God? Is there a higher being? I think that's next door, actually, if I read the sign right.
Tiger Mother.
That's right.
Tiger Mother. That stuff, you know, the book that just came out, but the Tiger Mom.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yep.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Parenting
for older. Things about interfaith intermarriage tend to do that also. I'm not sure that's a net positive. It depends what the program is. And there's a lot happening now around standardized testing. And there's a lot of anxiety about that. And my shul in Arlington just did something on that, and it sold out. It was insane. There were 200-something people there. No one thought to pitch it to the media, but I bet had they done it, they could have got the local Arlington person who covers for the Washington Post, because the general parental anxiety about anything becomes a trend story. Crises also become a story, but we hope we don't have the crises that we'd actually want the journalists for. And I just can't stress enough the interfaith piece. And this too gets back to your first question, is how do we get people in? If the goal is to draw people in, it's because they learn about us, say, oh, I didn't know about that program, let me Google it, let me search it, and then they say, oh, maybe that's something I would want to be a part of. And then the journalist who comes in and says, oh, that's something I should be following. And then you might have the chance of getting them to come to some other program or getting a chance that they would do something on a piece. It is rare that we have a speaker come to our settings that is himself or herself such a newsmaker that it's a must cover, must carry. If you do something around the Holocaust, if you do an annual Holocaust Remembrance Day, say in a garden, where you honor a high-profile person, that tends to get covered.
But it's also easy that the question with things like that is, who's your target audience as well, right? So it could get coverage, but depending on how you want to market yourself as an organization, it might be that you don't want to be the one that gets coverage for the Holocaust program. So I also think it's right, I mean, I'm wrong about this, but
you're very right about this.
The old saying about, you know, all exposure is good. I mean, is this true?
I would follow up with that message a little bit. Matt, I hear everything you're saying. I get it. Why?
That's exactly right. What's the goal of all this? So let me answer Dan and then you run. That, no, I am unalterably opposed to the school of thought that any coverage is good coverage. I think that's wrong. There is a school of thought in the PR world that when you get a clip in a newspaper, you send out the clip to the client and you measure the inches of the story, just how long it is, and then you translate it into the ad fees. And you say, this story was worth, in the New York Times, this was, you know, 20 inches, this story was worth $77,000. We were doing some work for an Israeli university that got their tuchuses kicked in a New York Times profile story. And we worked very hard to get them kicked less bad than they otherwise would have been. We were actually very proud of how less bad. They had an international firm that was also working with them that sent out this clip and actually said this clip was worth, I think it was $77,000. And the president of the university went insane. He said, you know, I would have paid $77,000 to have the story not be written. Okay, so yes, there are those pieces. The end goal of why do we want coverage, to me, is, you know, spans the whole gamut here. From having the people who are already with us feel good. You know, local weekly newspapers run so many photos of sports games and kids because they want people to see their kids in the newspaper because they feel good about themselves, about the town, and about the paper. And they sell more subscriptions because they might get to see their kid in the paper. Congregants of yours who see the synagogue written about in a favorable way, almost anywhere, will feel good and proud to be part of the shul. And that's good, that's worth it. People who are lapsed said, oh yeah, maybe I should do that. We send out a client in the news email in our firm, taking pride in the clips that we get. And we send out to a list of a few thousand people, not nearly often enough, because it's too long, probably two or three times a year. And without fail, we get business from it, from someone who we did a project work with at some point over the last 5 years, says, oh yeah, let me get back in touch with them. I've got this going on. This is that. You got someone who hasn't been there, someone who's thinking about it, someone who feels it, someone who shares it with a friend, and they tell some friends, and you get someone coming back in who might not have. And you hopefully get that person who is looking for something Jewishly, who sees this and wants to give it a try, or comes to a program, or looks it, or sees something, or they share it with somebody, and somehow they come back into Judaism. That's the Jewish piece of it. The other piece of it is to showcase to the non-Jewish world that we might have something that's relevant to non-Jews, and this showcases Judaism in a good light. And we want to share Judaism in a good light, and this is one way to do that. And then all the way on for our own kavod, that, you know, you like to see yourself in the paper. You should like to see yourself in the paper. It's good for you. Your wife likes to see yourself in the paper. You know, your kids like to see them in the paper. My wife likes to see me in the paper. My kids like to see me in the paper. But the benefit is to tell our story. And if our story is not a Holocaust Remembrance Day piece, then that's not it. But I would argue that I don't see a harm in a Holocaust Remembrance, just as, you know, playing this example through. I don't see the harm in that in the Jewish world. And I see a benefit to that in the non-Jewish world, that other people get to learn more about the Holocaust. Are there certain pieces that are not, that I don't want to read about? Okay. When I did a tour with Elliot Dorff and Jerry Epstein and who was the conservative on gay marriage and ordination? Joel Myers. And we went to Toronto and did a town hall meeting to see how this would work and to figure out how to talk about these three teshuvas and stuff. I didn't want anyone to read this. You know, I was embarrassed for some of this. You know, I didn't want this to be out there because this is like a real inside discussion fight that I was more than happy to not read about. When the time came to roll this out, I found myself standing on the street corner in Manhattan with Lori Goodstein from the New York Times, Alan Cooper from the Washington Post, who flew down for it, Rachel Zoll from AP, Alan from Reuters, the guy who just left the New York Star Ledger, New York Jewish Week Forward, you know, briefing them on what had happened. And by then it was too late. We were going to read about it, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly, because that was a story that we couldn't control how that was written about. And it was written as a very, in a very intolerant way, in the less intolerant way possible for the way that they wrote it. But by then it was ready to be written about. Those first pieces, I would have paid $77,000 not to have them written about. And we didn't pitch it, we didn't place it, and it was good that it wasn't. I imagine that stuff happens in your shul that you'd rather people don't write about. Or that is not on our message. The flip side to this, which is the bigger piece part of this, is and this happens, you know, from the rabbi level, the sort of president level, all the way up to the senator level. That a senator gets a phone call and says, "We want an op-ed on Libya." Says, "Great, I haven't been in the Washington Post, you know, yet this year. I'm going to write my op-ed on Libya." He writes this great op-ed on Libya, and they place it, and then 3 weeks later. They close down the federal government over budget, and kids can't go to school. And this senator, like, her issue is education. Like, she does education, education, education. And she writes the best piece she's ever written, and she gives it to the Washington Post. They say, "But we just did you." Say, "Yeah, yeah, but this is my issue." Like, "Well, we just did you. We can't write another op-ed from you." That's where we need to be careful about what our message is and talk about the pieces that we want to talk about in our proactive way. And figure out where we fit in. And we want to be at the top of that card that I talked about, but we don't want to be at the top of that card and just talk about everything and anything just for the sake of talking about them. You all know who your colleagues are in the Jewish community or the non-Jewish community, in the faith community, who are the media whores. Who are the ones who will talk about anything and give the quote for anything, you know, because the joke is that they give good quotes. You know, and they're going to call them up no matter what. You don't want to be that person, I hope. Because when they do want you, when they do need you, you want to be known for something. You want to be known for standing for something. And you need to figure out what those issues are. And stick to that. And then, in the beginning, if you don't have a public profile, if you don't have a media profile, then you can be less selective. You can say, "Okay, I want to be out there, I want to talk about these pieces, so, you know, let me talk about them." But all in a way that you don't get into too much hot water with your congregants or with your board or with whoever the lay leaders are. That, you know, maybe you just don't want to do another interview on Israel because I just can't stand to deal with the right-left politics in my shul. Or maybe, you know, I'm sick of the left wing yelling at me, so I'm going to go out there and do something on it. You know, we all have that. The piece that I did mention when we talk about journalists, this is a good segue into, you know, pitching and placing with them, is there is not a single person in any town that any of you are from or anyone else is from at this conference, unless they're from Israel, whose beat or job it is to cover Israel. There is no one who sits in Scranton who covers Israel. There's no one who sits in Vancouver who covers Israel. There's no one who sits in Denver who covers Israel. There's no one who sits in Washington who covers Israel. They don't. They sit in Israel to cover Israel. Religion reporters and the beat reporters that we talk to do not cover Israel. They generally could not care less about Israel. The only time that they cover Israel is if something really, 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 really bad happens. Really bad happens. And then they're doing a local community reaction to Israel. The Itamar slang does not rise to that level. It has been a while. You know, Gaza war, Lebanon war, the spate of the suicide bombings in the mid-90s, mid-late 90s, those were like real moments. Mm-hmm. When there was the emergency campaign for the Federation, we took Shimon Peres around to 8 different cities, and people cared because Shimon Peres was there, not because the Federation was doing an event on this piece. And that's a place I'd be really, really careful to know the reporters' beats and to talk to them about their things and not necessarily our things. And a lot of that means saying no. And that's not easy. It means saying, "No, I understand, Rabbi, or I understand, Cantor, you've been at the synagogue for 25 years. That's a major, major anniversary. We're doing a great dinner for you. We're raising money. We're doing Monte Carlo night or Las Vegas night. We're doing a Vegas night." If you went to any editor of a Jewish newspaper, even in the smaller towns, you'd say, "Are you kidding me? I have 6 synagogues. I have 4 schools. I have two federations and five federation agencies, I'd be doing an anniversary story every single week. Give me something that's different. Give me something that matters. So how do we do that? What do we find? What's that newsworthy nugget? What's that piece that could work? I just got roped into going to a Capital Camps fundraising dinner for their scholarship fund. My kid goes to overnight camp there. It's the Federation Jewish Camp in D.C. My wife went there. He's the first alumni kid who goes there. And they obviously wanted folks to cover it. I said, there's nothing to cover. No one's going to cover a fundraising dinner for the camp. And I listened to a woman get up, a mother get up, who talked about her special needs kid. And how he was unable to do anything real. It was, you know, separate from school, and they tried to mainstream him, and he never had summers, and his brother was always embarrassed of him and couldn't deal, and he went to school. And how he went to camp. And the parents of the special needs camp pay almost double for camp, and the rest comes from the scholarship fund to make up for the one-to-one counselor ratio with them. And how he was able to live in the bunk, and how his brother saw him Israeli dancing. They were able to dance together. And how he was able to play sports. He was able to play sports. For the first time ever, they were able to be on a team together. And what it meant for their sibling relationship, and how she goes to the mall now in Bethesda, and she bumps into kids. Well, you know, this is Bethesda, and they bump into kids, and kids come up to them and give them a high five and say hello. And she's amazed that what this means for him. And she's telling the story, and I'm like the jaded former journalist Washingtonian who's, you know, not emotional about anything, and you're sitting this thing like, why am I here? And like, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. Okay, this is why I'm here. My mind's going to that, not to the, you know, kids whose parents lost their jobs and can't go to camp. They should just go to the pool this summer. Okay. You know, this is why I'm here. And this is the story. The story is about, you know, this camp that is helping special needs kids. I'm sure there's a million other camps doing it also. But told the right way to the right journalist at the right time for the right camp gets this there. Now, you might ask, well, to what end? Is this a net negative? Like, would this somehow harm the camp because people who aren't special needs kids, would they say, I don't want my mainstream healthier kid going to a camp for special needs kids? And I'm just making this up right now, but I could see someone thinking that. So how this story gets done and where it's placed and who this goes to is a critical piece of what the message is. And if the camp said to me, oh my God, man, don't place this story. We're sold out on special needs kids. I have a waiting list 100 people long. We can't afford it. And this would just get me a waiting list of 500 people long. And I already can't sleep at night because we can't help take care of these kids. This is a bad story for us. Do a story about how kids are coming to spirituality through camp, and it's keeping them Jewish, and the Catholic camps, which are on the wane, are now seeing a rise also. This is a trend story about faith and camping. That's the story I want. So even though that piece touched you, forget about that. Do this piece about how you saw 25, 15-year-old kids give up their Saturday night to come and sing at this mock song festival because this has worked and means something for them because they got to fill those bunks. Possible. And that's what gets us to this pitch. So we need to know what these journalists care about. And we know what they care about by reading what they write about. If we're not reading what they write about, we can't know. Before you want to call a journalist, and now it's just so damn easy that, you know, it used to be really hard to read what journalists were writing about unless you were in that city with that newspaper. If I want to know what the Seattle Post-Intelligencer education reporter has written about for his last 10 stories, I go on their website, I Google his name, it has a page for his last 10 stories, I can see his blog, I can see his Twitter feed, and I know exactly what I think from what he's writing he cares about. You can tell what folks care about. You can also tell and read through some of their BS. If they say, I just did that, you could say, well, it might feel that way, but I, you know, looked it up, and I see you haven't written a story about this in a year and a half. If yours is one of the shuls that partners with the mosque for these twinning things once a year, they say, yeah, I've done a ton on, you know, Muslim-Jewish stuff. Well, actually, you know, why don't you go back and check that? Because I haven't seen it, and I think it would be nice for you to, it would be good for you to do this. And that's one way of being able to push back against that first no. But we also know, wow, they just did that. I must have missed that story. Wow, you know, I must have missed that story. So we know who they are, we know what they care about, and we never call up and ask them for a favor. It's never, can you do me a favor and cover this? To me, and this is a very personal piece, people actually have a you know, different school of thoughts on this, I never say thank you to a journalist for covering anything, ever. I say, that was a really thorough story. You did a very good job, you know, with all due respect, balancing those two competing pieces. Boy, that was really tough. How'd you get that done on deadline? Because if someone says thank you, that means to me like, oh, you're welcome. Did I do them a favor? And that's not what they're asking for. They want something that's newsworthy, and that's that piece of it. So there's a way to compliment a journalist that's not thanking them for doing me a favor. It's a pet peeve of mine as a former journalist, but also I hate when someone tells me what's news. To say, I've got something that's newsworthy for you. You know, I've got something that's a great story for you. No, I'm going to be the judge of that. I've got something that you might be interested in. I've got something that I think you'll be interested in. I've got something that I'd like to share with you that I'm excited about. It's another school of thought. I hate getting cover letters when someone says, as you will see from my resume, no, don't tell me what I'm going to see, because I don't, you don't know what I'm going to see. And there are many journalists who actually are of the same school of thought, that they don't like when people call them up and says, this is newsworthy. They want to make that judgment, but make your best pitch to them. And the best pitch...
But say it is interesting to you or not?
This is very interesting to me. I'd like to share this with you. I think this is exciting. Other words that I would use. And the pitch is rarely synagogue-focused. It's rarely rabbi-focused. It's rarely school-focused. It's on a piece that the average reader would care about who doesn't care about a synagogue, rabbi, or school. And I can't tell you how many press releases we still see today. You know, Temple Rodef F. Shalom will host an exciting panel discussion with Rabbi Schwartzman, cantor leader, and the head of the school. What's it about? Who cares? It matters so much less almost where it is or who's saying it. It matters what they're doing. We put out polls all the time, and it can't be about such and such organization released a poll today on this for this conference. No. You know, Hispanics in America are more likely to believe that the U.S. is too favors Israel more than the Palestinians, according to a new poll released today. Conducted by, for them, the poll also shows this. It's a way of thinking and writing like a journalist. It's a way of thinking and writing like an AP or Reuters Wire story that has the news up front to it. And that's where, before I did any of this, I was a counselor at a band camp for disadvantaged kids. Before being a counselor at band camp was a punchline of a joke of a movie. And also before I had ever seen the movie The Music Man, we used to tell the kids to put down their instruments and to sing the sheet music we had just given them. If they can't sing it, they can't play it. If you can't sing the rhythms, how can you possibly play it? You don't know it. And the same thing's true for this. If you can't say it, then you can't say it to the journalist. We in our offices, and I've been doing this, Steve Rubinus, my partner's been doing this for even longer, my colleague's been doing this, we talk through our pitches before we call journalists to each other. We have a conversation. This is what I'm going to say. If no one's around, I'll do it. I will say it to myself. I will think it through, and I might even make notes and have a notepad out in front of me because I know the points I need to get through. If we can't talk it through to ourselves or to our friends or to our colleagues or to our spouses or to our friends or to whomever else is, then we certainly can't talk about it when we get on the phone with the journalist. And this is where that earlier part about building that relationship. So the most that we can, we're not calling them, they know who we are, or they know what the agency is, the better off that we are. And the other piece of this is to not be the annoying one. The worst reputation that we as a community have is as whiners and complainers about Israel. We work for J-Street, we work for the New Israel Fund. You ask anybody here who knows me, they'll say I'm, you know, off the left-wing scale on this stuff. We also work for JCPA and the Federations and Hadassah and others. So that's our spectrum of world that we play in. So I'm not part of the camera crowd. Having said that, I believe that groups like Camera have caused more damage for people like you all calling journalists, people like me calling journalists, than anything else that we could ever do. Because the newspapers, they hear the Jewish community calling and the editors roll their eyes. Because whenever they do a Wired story on Israel, they get 50 phone calls, they get 50 emails. Their newspapers were all boycotted by Jews in their area. There are committees of watchdogs of the newspapers on Israel, and we get lumped in with that. And we can't afford to be. It's almost unheard of to call a letters editor to pitch a letter to the editor, but we do it sometimes. And I called the letters editor of the New York Times about 4 months ago to pitch a letter. And I said, the first words I said, I'm so sorry to be calling you, you don't know me. My name is Matt Dorf, I work with this group, and I know you must be getting a million letters today and a million calls like this, but if you read five of them, try this one, I think it's got something in there that is different. And he laughed. He's like, it's so funny that you say that. I get more letters and more phone calls and more emails the second we run something on Israel that, you know, you're lucky I didn't hang up on you. We kind of laughed together. He read the letter and he ran it. Now, I think he would have run it anyway if he had seen the letter because it was that good and different, but it didn't matter. We have that bad negative reputation. So I share this in, it's okay to get drawn into those conversations if they want to have them, but as we're developing these relationships, let's not have them be about Israel. If you're given the option of going into the local daily newspaper with the Federation lay leader and the three Federation donors who are the biggest advertisers for the paper to meet the editors and talk about how the paper works, I'd say don't go. Let someone else do that part. Let someone else be that guy. Be that girl. You be the other person, because it won't do you any good to be lumped into that. And then, when a story runs, that's great, like we talked about. You know, there's always that follow-up is perfectly good, perfectly appropriate. You know, wow, you did a great job on that deadline, followed through on that. I heard back from a lot of people, that story moved them. There's ways to do that, thank you. And if you ever need to complain, which happens, because there's a story out there, and I would just be remiss if we don't talk about this for a moment here. It's okay to complain. It just has to start with the journalist who wrote the story. You can't go to the editor first. You got to go to the person who wrote it. And you can't blame them for the headline if you don't like the headline, because that's not their fault. And if we need to go to the editor, we can. You get to go to the publisher once ever to complain about something, and then he or she will come down on the editor, and then the editor might fix it for a week, and then when the editor's not paying any attention anymore, the reporter really hates you, so that backfires. You have to ask yourself, was it really worth it to complain about that piece? And the last piece on this piece is to know the rules, to know the ground rules. There's almost no such thing as talking to somebody off the record anymore. I would strongly encourage not to do it. There used to be off the record, deep background, on the record, and they all meant different things. You know, off the record meant they couldn't even tell anyone else that they spoke to anyone like you, and they couldn't use that information to call anybody. It doesn't mean that anymore. Now it means they'll run everything that you said, maybe with quote marks around it, just not quote you by name. And that's a real dangerous place to get into. And hopefully you don't get into that place.
In the lunch that we had with Colin, they said question and answers were off the record, but his prepared speech was fine. Mm-hmm. What can they do with, if there was media in the room?
Off the record. You asked a very good question. Off the record is a voluntary arrangement between journalist and reporter. And the rule must be struck in advance. Howard Kaur, the executive APAC, gave a speech to the JCPA plenum in Washington about 3 weeks ago. And there was a Wall Street Journal blogger in the room. And someone noticed he was in the room halfway through the speech. He said, no, you can't be here. This is off the record. And he said, the hell it is. Now, I've been here. I'm using this. And he did. And that was, needed to make those ground rules. There are people in my business who send out press releases or send something out, this is off the record, or this is embargoed until a certain time, meaning that they can't run it until a certain time. And unless the journalist affirmatively agrees to that embargo, there's no embargo. And there was someone who burned them once on it because I'm sick and tired of getting these emails. That's not true. This isn't how this works. And you can't do that. If you wind up in these situations, it's worth talking to somebody, talking through how to really manage these rules. Today, what happened here, if there was a journalist in the room, they could cover it. What they're really asking for, and this was the DOD Middle East guy who was here today, what they're really asking for is his speech was vetted and was signed off on. If I had to guess, there's a memo sitting somewhere with five or six sets of initials on it. For his speech, and his answers to the questions are not vetted. Because he wasn't reading from guidance, or if he was, the guidance might go off. So, it's asking you not to tweet about what happened there. And if there was a journalist in the room, which I don't believe there was, it would be asked to not quote anything from the Q&A. How that worked with the journalist in the room, I don't know. I wasn't there. But that would mean that they would not be able to be in the room, or if they were in the room, they couldn't use it at all. And if I was a journalist, I would have left, and I would have grabbed you on the way out and said, tell me what he said. Or I would have stood in the hallway, heard what he said, and then quoted him saying, a participant said, can I do something? Did you hear that too? You say, yes, or according to a participant, he said this. So there's like games people play, but the rules are...
Trust me, you didn't say anything.
I think many of us have been in a position of being either misquoted, quoted out of context, having pieces we've written, edited mm-hmm. to change them substantively. Are there ways to avoid those things, to give a quote, to
yes.
ask to see something before it goes to print? And how do you go about that?
There's two ways. The most important way is to never be able to say, I was misquoted saying something I should have never said in the first place. Because most misquotes are not actually the journalist's misquote. It's that we said something that we shouldn't have said, and we get misquoted saying it. So that's the first piece of it. The second piece of it is it depends on who the journalist is. The best way to speak is to be the most exact you could possibly be. And with all respect to the rabbis sitting here, rabbis are the worst people at giving sound bites to journalists, because the vast majority of conversations I have seen rabbis have with me, with congregants, with journalists, it's an arc of a persuasion argument building up to a conclusion. Well, you need to just start with a conclusion. This is very different than how we usually talk, because the part that builds up to that arc is the he said, the she said, the this, the that, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the piece taken out of context, and someone's scribbling down in the notebook and they either forget, usually time, not deliberately, or they feel like they have something, who got you, that sounded good, I'm just going to use that, and by the time you get to your point, they've tuned out. So you got to make your point. Whatever the point is, make it and stick to it, and it might not be the perfect answer because you didn't get all the context into it that you wanted. But the most important part is to get the part that you, the quote that you want to read is what you need to tell them, not persuade them that you're right about what you're trying to say, is one piece of it. The second piece is answer the question you wish they asked, not the question they asked. Just because they ask the question, answer what you want to say, not as well. And they could ask you a million times, like, I have said what I'm going to say about this, and that's what it is. And then there's two other traps people fall into. One, not so famous acronym is KISS, keep it stupid simple. There's a simpler way of saying it, say it that way. And the worst trap that we all fall into is you use a word that someone asks you in the answer. Is he a wife beater? No, it's ridiculous for you to say he's a wife beater. And all of a sudden you're quoted saying it's ridiculous to call him a wife beater, where the other person raised that issue, but you're the one raising it that he might be a wife beater. So that's something affirmatively that you raised. Should the mayor be impeached for, running down the street, with his pants down? I didn't know the mayor ran down the street with his pants down. And this happens even worse times during times of crises. And we could do a whole session of crisis com. But where someone in the synagogue office gets a phone call, we heard that the police arrested somebody. We heard that they're investigating embezzlement or something. And the person, this poor, 89-year-old who's worked in the office for the last 40 years says, this is the first we're hearing about this. This is the first that I'm hearing about it. And all of a sudden, there's a news story. What's your name? Sadie. When Sadie answered the phone in the synagogue, said this is the first official was hearing about this. And then you have to back down from there. So there's ways to handle those kind of pieces. And know that whatever you say can be quoted. Now, the journalist who does this to you often, or the other pieces, you can ask for them to read your quotes back to you. It's disrespectful of the journalist. It's very time-consuming. It's a pain in the neck. But if this is a real pattern and something which you're really concerned about, or you're in trouble with your own board, you're in trouble with your own leaders, or someone else about, that's something which you can do.
I have often said to a couple of journalists who might have a little bit of a relationship, can I think for 5 minutes and call you back or email you back with my quote?
Right.
In etiquette world, they've been okay.
The most of
me, is that okay, or do they want it on the spot? Because I want to do what you said. I want to think and get the right word.
The most, I would rather miss an opportunity than be wrong in an opportunity because I didn't do that. When a reporter calls you, and you know their deadline, so you like know what's going on. If it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a daily paper, you're kind of screwed. You probably can't do that. If it's 2 o'clock, you lie. You know, I would love to talk to you. I'm in a meeting right now. I'm going to get rid of this congregant, and I'll call you back in 15 minutes. You hang up the phone, and you say, oh, shit. And you know, freak out, you know, if it's something important you've got to figure out, or just get your thoughts down. There is nothing wrong with reading something on paper. There are a ton of journalists who would rather that you send them a quote by email, because they cut and paste and they put it in, and it spares them the time. And that's why developing this type of relationship, you'll be able to afford.
Take that as an authentic quote.
The vast majority of them will. There are some old school people who will say, you know, in an email. And I can live with that. I don't think that that's
okay.
An interview, you know, sent by email. Right, you know, you can even joke, if you'd like me to read this to you so you don't have to say this was an email, I'm happy to. It depends how well you know the person. And then you're also interacting with whatever kind of personality you have. If you're like, you're a joking person, they're a joking person, you can do that. They're like all straight-laced in business, you're all straight-laced in business, then you can talk to them that way. But,
I was in that situation when they needed the quote right now. Mm-hmm. My answer was pausing, thinking the phrase through, and then giving it to the, you know, so it was not a smooth answer, but.
No problem.
Correct. That's okay to do.
As long as you're not on live TV.
Thinking it through and saying it carefully.
As long as you're not on live TV, absolutely. And yes. Yeah, and you know, we all have stalling techniques. You know, that's a really good question. Now, you raise a very good point there. You've given us a lot to think about. Or you say, give me a second, get my thoughts together, and you have that awkward silence. I'd rather have the awkward silence than have you quoted somewhere saying, than have you misquoted somewhere saying that you should have never said in the first place. And that is.
But they respect the pause, they respect the silence, as long as you're giving them the.
If it's 5:30 at night, they're clicking and the editor's like, where's your story? Give me 20 inches, it gets harder and harder. But yes, for the most part, yes, depending on the journalist.
Now, can you comment on the etiquette that applies if the journalist is a reporter and there's a camera running and they're taking videotape for the newsletter or whatever, and they ask you a question, but you really do want 2 minutes to you know, you're going to say this into a camera, you want 2 minutes to think what you're going to say.
Take the, as long as it's not live TV, take the time. You know, you ask me a question, give me a moment to get my thoughts together.
You never heard about a journalist running a story, a rabbi can't make up his mind, watch for 2 minutes.
No, generally not. Generally not. And then it also depends, you know, if you've got a minder with you. I did some interviews very recently with a kind of, you know, big name personality, and there were a couple of really, really tough questions. Some of which we had talked through beforehand, and one that we had not. And we couldn't say, oh, we're going to go huddle over here for a minute. We'll be right back. And I jumped in. I didn't jump in to answer the question. I jumped in because it was a journalist that I knew a lot, and to buy that 30, 45, 50 seconds to buy that time. And these are games. You know, reporters are not our friends. They're games that we play with them. You know, they need something. We have something to offer. And the last piece, which I'll leave with, is that the interview is over when you're left alone. That when you're walking someone down the hall, or you're doing something else, that's when the interview's over, not when you get up and the tape recorder's off and you're walking down the hall. I have a friend who was an exec of a Jewish group who had a story in a major daily paper who said something that he shouldn't have said. So how did this happen? He said, I made, and he actually was a former PR exec. So I made, you know, mistake number 12. You know, I was walking down the hall, walking her out. We'd spent 4 hours together at this meeting and this hearing, this other stuff, and it was the last thing that I said before she got in the elevator. And he said it, he shouldn't have said it, and she quoted him saying it. And it caused some damage, but, you know, it was fine. Okay, thank you very much for your time today. One piece which we didn't get to.
Let me give you a piece of paper. We didn't talk about op-eds and letters to the editor. Thank you.